Top of the day, everybody. Mike in Clovis, California, thank you. He writes, good to hear your voice again, Art. The solar event you're thinking of was the X-28 flare on 4 November 2003. Now, what I find interesting about that is if, in fact, the flare in the 1800s was larger than the X-28 flare, that doesn't quite make sense to me, because the scientists that sent up the satellite that monitors solar flares should have been aware that we could have a solar flare that large, and therefore should have calibrated their instruments to include the possibility of a flare that large or larger. And yet, when the 4 November 2003 flare occurred, we heard that the scientists were baffled and surprised and shocked and said there couldn't be a flare that big, therefore they hadn't calibrated their instruments for it. So somewhere there's got to be a story. All right, listen, my guest, of course, is Dr. Michio Kaku, one of the greatest minds in the universe that we know of, and it's your opportunity to ask him questions. The numbers you just heard are the way to do that, the portal, as it were. So stay right where you are. How about that, Dr. Kaku? The big flare, the X-28, I think they estimate it was on 4 November 2003. If that didn't measure up to the one in the 1800s, why hadn't the scientists calibrated the satellite for the possibility of something at least as large as what occurred in the 1800s?
The reason is that most scientists are not even aware of the Carrington event of 1859. You have to go back to old yellowing records, and then you realize, oh, my God, it was humongous. But back then, they just had telegraph wires. We have to recalculate what might have happened if that Carrington event took place with satellites, with power stations, with credit cards, with Wall Street. And then we realize, holy smokes, it would have paralyzed the economy, set off food riots, rescue crews totally paralyzed. So quite frankly, we were caught with our pants down because we are very young in the space age, very young in the electric age. We've never seen an event of that magnitude before with satellites, with power stations. And so when this recent event took place, we were also caught off guard. Again, some of that incident took place because a sunspot, like a rifle, ejected a beam of radiation. But the beam of radiation rotates as the sun rotates. The Earth also moves around the sun. So it's like hitting a moving target. So for a while, I still remember NASA was releasing warnings to satellite operators saying your satellites may go down. As it turned out, the Earth and the sun were not quite aligned, and we dodged a bullet. But a warning went out for the first time, stating that, watch out, satellites may get wiped out. We may have a disruption, temporary disruption of our communication networks. The Carrington event would be simultaneous. The entire planet would get wiped out of its communications and its refrigerators and its credit cards and its Wall Street.
And I guess with the Carrington event, we had no we didn't have monitoring in place to really know it was an X whatever.
We were clueless. We didn't even know what it was. I mean, Carrington was an astronomer who saw this gigantic solar flare, tried to contact his friends, but, you know, gee, he's just an astronomer, right? And lo and behold, you know, about 10 minutes later, all hell breaks loose. And later, people realized, hey, you know, he's the guy who actually spotted what was happening. It was the sun that's responsible. Now we look back at these yellowing records, and we can recalibrate what it would take to knock out a telegraph wire of 1859, what it would take to create a solar flare seen in Cuba during nighttime so that you can read the newspaper at night in Cuba. You can calculate what it would be, and we realize, oh, my God, it was huge.
Okay, now, back for a second to, the human brain and the meshing of a machine with it. Is that going to happen? And if it does it ever produce immortality, basically immortality for a human?
Well, there's several ways you may approach the question of immortality. One is genetically. We're beginning to unravel the genes that seem to control the aging process. We're beginning to understand what is called caloric restriction and the genes that control caloric restriction. That's starving yourself so that you live longer. You eat 30% less, you live 30% longer. But also, as you mentioned, maybe it's possible to put our brain inside a computer. Personally, I would not want to wake up one day and find myself inside a laptop and realize I live forever as a laptop. I don't find that very appealing. However,
well, not with our current operating systems.
Right. However, in the movie Surrogates, they laid out a different scenario. What happens if you wake up one morning, you find out that you're beautiful, you find out you have muscles and you have superhuman abilities, and you're immortal. You live forever. Well, there's several problems. In that movie, the human body was in a pod. It rots. It gets older. So you still have a finite lifespan. However, one day we may be able to perhaps merge with this technology. This technology now is a century away from us, at least a century away. We barely understand how the mind works, let alone creating an artificial mind. But some people have claimed that maybe neuron for neuron, we can replace all our neurons with transistors so that one day we wake up and literally find neuron for neuron, the same architecture in the human of the human mind inside a machine. We're a long ways from that. Right now, our most advanced computer is called BlueJean. It's used by the military. I had a chance to film at BlueJean at Livermore, where they build hydrogen bombs. And that BlueJean computer can mimic a mouse brain for a few minutes. That's about the limit of what we can do. We can make a mouse immortal for a few minutes.
All right. I've promised phones, and so here they come. Here is Perry in Lompoc, California. Perry, you're on the air.
Hi, Art. God bless to you and your family. I'm so happy for you. I haven't talked to you since 1992.
Wow.
So I know it's been too long, but a constant listener. Dr. Kaku, I really appreciate the alternate universe. Elvis is alive in one universe, and he's dead in the other. You know, that really
right.
Doesn't help. And that is so fascinating. But what I wanted to ask you, though, is... if the universes, the multiverses, are little bubbles, and what is beyond the bubble?
Well, if the Big Bang has an expanding universe, then what is the universe expanding into? And the answer would be hyperspace. That is another dimension beyond the dimensions that we're familiar with. Now, you mentioned being dead and alive simultaneously in different universes. In principle, that is mathematically possible. People ask the question, is Elvis Presley still alive in another universe? And the answer is, well, you can't rule it out. The quantum theory is very bizarre. Electrons can exist in multiple states, so why not universes? So if you have what is called quantum cosmology, then you can actually have a universe where Elvis Presley is still alive, which means in some sense that even your loved ones who have passed away will still be alive in another universe. There are other universes, of course, where you may be dead, but there could be universes where your loved ones, your parents that passed away, could still be alive. This is well within the quantum theory.
Wow, that's really fascinating to even contemplate. Eric in Springfield, Missouri, hello there. You're on the air with Dr. Kaku.
Mr. Bell, it's a privilege to talk to you. I'm listening to you on AM 560 here in Springfield.
That's
and I've been listening to you since, I believe, 1995 when I was finishing my graduate studies at WashU in St. Louis.
Yes, sir.
Professor Kaku, I've enjoyed using your class or your book Visions in my class that I taught at Drury.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple of questions. The two traditions of Buddhism and Shinto or Kaminomichi in Japan have, of course, shaped Japanese thought for a long time. And the concept of kami, kind of a creative force that permeates nature, has always interested me. And I was wondering, have either of these traditions influenced your worldview as you were growing up, and do they affect you now?
Well, two things are important. First, the Japanese attitude toward robots is influenced by the Shinto religion, which sees spirits everywhere, even inside metal, so that in America, children may run away from robots because they see Arnold Schwarzenegger as a Terminator robot fighting the T-1000. In Asia, everything has a spirit in it, in especially in the Shinto religion. So the Japanese embrace robots very easily. In fact, 30% of all robots are in Japan. If you ever visited Japan, you know, the robots greet you at the store, the robot toys everywhere. People feel very comfortable with robots, especially as the population ages. These are going to be the future robot nurses. However, when I was growing up, there was a problem there because in Buddhism, there is no God. There is no, there's just nirvana. There's no beginning. There's no end. However, in the Christian religion, and I was raised as a Christian, actually, in the Presbyterian Church as a child, there is a Genesis. There is a chapter 1, verse 1, where God said, let there be light. So I grew up with two contradictory paradigms in my head. Now with the multiverse, we can meld them for the first time in history. We can now meld these two ideas. We're now leaning toward, we physicists are now leaning toward eternal Genesis. Big bangs happening all the time. So there is a Genesis. There is a Judeo-Christian moment where somebody with a white beard said, let there be light. However, it exists with other universes in a nirvana, timelessness. The nirvana is hyperspace. It's a higher dimension, in fact, 11 dimensions, we think. And so we have this beautiful melding of Judeo-Christian thinking with Buddhism.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Professor Patton. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the very interesting question. All right, to Eugene, Oregon. Michael, you're on the air with Dr. Kaku.
Hey, it's the first time I talk with you, Art. I've talked with George and Ian before, but now with you, it's a privilege. I have a couple questions for the professor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I'd love to connect with you privately and talk because I have so many questions and I think I may have some answers for things. But I saw an Outer Limits show once to where they were neurologically connected to the internet, like Lawnmower Man. You touched on it a little while ago to where you could put on a helmet or something and control a machine. But why couldn't we in the future put on a helmet or plug in a device to where it's like we could actually be connected to the internet, and would it drive certain individuals crazy if they couldn't handle it? You know what I'm saying?
Well, there have been some thoughts about connecting the brain directly to the internet. One problem is that the brain has an operating system quite different from ours. We use Windows as an operating system. The brain actually has no operating system at all. There's no Pentium chip there. There's no operating system, no programming, no software. The brain is a learning machine. It's a neural network. It rewires itself every time it learns something. Now, your laptop is just as stupid today as it was yesterday. Your laptop never gets smarter. It doesn't learn anything. But that's what the brain is. The brain is a learning machine. So marrying these two architectures is quite difficult. Right at the present time, we use MRI machines, and we use EEG machines to sense brain waves and electrical signals and blood flow in order to control a laptop. So that's how it's done. A direct hookup between the brain and a computer, well, that was achieved at Brown University with something called BrainGate. They took a stroke victim, put a chip in the surface of the brain, connected the chip to a laptop, and the person is totally paralyzed but can now move the cursor on the screen, read email, write email, surf the web, play video games, and he's totally paralyzed.
Wow.
That's the first attempt, the first major attempt for a direct hookup between a living brain and a laptop computer. In fact, my colleague Stephen Hawking cannot communicate with the outside world. He's losing control of his facial muscle. That's how he communicates with the outside world, through blinks and through grimaces of his face. Computers translate that into messages. That's how he communicates with the world. One day he'll lose control over his facial muscles and his eyeballs, and he won't be able to communicate. At that point, maybe we put a chip in somebody like that's brain and have a direct hookup so that he can directly control a laptop computer. Now, another way to control the internet with the brain is to put the internet in a contact lens and wear a contact lens with the internet right on the contact lens. Your eyeball is an extension of your brain. It's almost a direct extension of your brain. Your eyeball really is part of your brain. So the easiest way to interface the brain with the internet is to put the internet on a contact lens. So so that when you see somebody, you immediately see their biography, who they are, where they're from, and if they're speaking a different language, you'll see subtitles because, you know, the internet will translate what this person is saying. As you look at them, you'll be able to identify people's faces. You'll never be tongue-tied when you bump into somebody. You'll see their biography as you talk to them, and you'll see subtitles that they're speaking a different language. So that's what it would look like if we can connect the human brain to a contact lens, which is hooked to the internet.
What about a direct connection to the optic nerve?
That's being done now at UCLA with the artificial retina. You can now put a chip in the retina of a blind person.
Right.
And depending upon how many pixels there are, the person can make out the outlines of people, the outlines of furniture. And, of course, it's only a matter of time before we increase the number of pixels in this artificial retina. And that work is being done, again, in California, in Los Angeles. And that could be the time when we begin not only to correct the vision of blind people, but even have supervision. X-ray vision, which you see in Superman comics, that's actually possible, just like you see in Superman comics. It's called backscattered X-rays. It's being speeded up, by the way, because of the recent terrorist scare at airports now. They're speeding up the deployment of backscattered X-rays. So you will literally see right through people's clothes, just like in Superman comics. I mean, every teenage boy reads about that and dreams about that when they read Superman comics. It's coming to an airport next to you very soon.
All the way to Florida, and a first-time caller. Hi, you're on with Art Bell and Dr. Michio Kaku.
Yes, you said Dave, correct?
I didn't say Dave. I said Florida.
Oh, sorry, sir. Yes, I wasn't even sure if I was up. But yes, you were just talking about those body scanners. I'm not really sure if I agree with those being installed in all the airports because I heard they're actually naked body scanners. But that's kind of a side issue. I had a question for Michio Kaku real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yes, fire away.
Yes, sir. You guys were talking about global warming a little bit ago, and I'm still kind of up in the air on the whole issue, as a lot of people still are. I agree with you, Art, that those emails were not really a smoking gun.
Well, but, I never found anything. I saw a lot of embarrassing stuff and silly stuff, but I really never found, and I did a lot of reading, because I've been convinced about global warming, so I wanted to see if there was something there.
Yes, sir. I myself, like I said, I'm not too convinced just yet. And there is a lot of information in those emails that does seem to suggest that there could be some sort of corruption and funny business going on. But my question to the professor, real quick, was just about there's like some sort of petition, and it looks like it was signed by over 31,000 American scientists rejecting global warming. I'm just wondering more about that and you guys' take on that.
All right. I don't know of that petition, Professor.
I'm not sure about that particular petition. I've seen other lists, but if you look at the list carefully, they're concerned people. They think maybe there's a fraud going on, but they're not scientists. I mean, they're not professors. They're not PhDs. They don't have access to computer programs. They're concerned citizens, which, of course, they have a right to say what they feel like. But they're not PhD level. They don't have access to computers, or big computers, to do simulations. And so they just, it's their opinion. And we live in a free society, so that's okay. Now, also, by the way, about seeing through closed at airports, that's exactly what these machines do. It's exactly like Superman comics. These are called backscattered X-rays, and it was perfected, several years ago. And they could be coming to an airport next to you, whether you like it or not. But it's literally like Superman comics.
All right, we've got a break here, Dr. Kaku. Stay right where you are. A country where they turn back time. One of these days, folks, I would really like to do a show about where I live and tell you all about it. It's like a different universe. Robbie in Tokyo, Japan, just up north of me here, says, great show, Art. I love the robot Shinto connection. I've lived here in Japan since 93, and this is the first time I've ever thought about that. Wow. True. Japan is just full of robots. It's an amazing place. Dr. Kaku has a new television show, and you're going to want to check it out. It's on Sci-Fi Science. That's Sci-Fi Science, and it's every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. So again, if you're intrigued by that, which you've been hearing this evening, and you want to see visuals, which of course help help the mind grasp the concepts. That'd be the way to do it. Tuesday night, 10 o'clock, Sci-Fi Science. We'll be right back. Aaron in Mesa, Arizona says, hey, Art, about the body scanners. I'm a nudist, so I think everybody should just fly nude. Hey, listen, Aaron, the way things are going, don't rule it out. I guess the rest of us just have to hope for the body scanner and soon at that. All right, let's go to Mississippi. Dennis in Mississippi, you're on the air.
Hello, Art, and Dr. Tuck. It was nice talking with both of you, and I'm a big fan and longtime listener of both your programs.
Thank you.
My question dealt with y'all talking about Avatar and downloading of human consciousness into artificial bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a popular sci-fi anime series called Ghost in the Shell, and I don't know if you've ever heard of either one, if you've heard of it.
No, but go on.
Okay. In that, in the not-too-distant future, people are able to record and digitally download their human brain into artificial bodies, cyborgs or androids or even robots. And for ordinary people, you can be cybernized and be able to connect with the internet directly without the use of a computer. And I was wondering if you saw that as a possibility in the future and how long that might take.
Okay. Well, steps are being made in that direction. However, we have to be very clear about this. The architecture of the brain, neuron for neuron, has never been completely worked out. Right now, we have a project to reverse engineer the brain of an insect, and it's taking a lot of time, a gigantic number of CD discs filled up, just cataloging the location of all the neurons inside a fruit fly. That's what's being done today. Eventually, we'll get to the brain of a mouse to reverse engineer every single neuron of a mouse. But that's, you know, maybe decades away before we can do that. Now, to simulate the neurons, we do that with BlueGene, a military computer at the Livermore National Laboratory. And so far, we can only mimic the thinking of a mouse brain for a few minutes and a cat brain for a few seconds. So you see how far we have to go. The human brain has 100 billion neurons, not the hundreds of thousands that a bug has. And even for bugs, it's taken an awful lot of work to slice and dice the brain of a fruit fly and then microscopically, with electron microscope, identify the location of every single neuron just to recreate a fruit fly brain. So we have a long ways to go before that science fiction dream is a reality. I'd say by end of the century, by the end of the century, we may have a neural map of every single neuron of the human brain. But that's still a long ways coming. And then we have to simulate that, each neuron with a transistor. So we have a long ways to go before we can download ourselves and become immortal.
Professor, I'm a cat person. I've got three cats here. Brought them all the way from... In fact, one of them, actually, I got here, took to the U.S., and then brought back here again, been around the world. Cat brains, I'm told, operate mostly in the alpha state. And there was this cat that was able to predict when people would die. It would go and lie down next to people who were ready to die. Inevitably, it was correct again and again and again and again. It was in an older age care home, and it kept predicting people's deaths simply by lying down next to the person who was about to die.
So people would run every time the cat came, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. Is it possible that such thing could be true, or is it, that a cat really could predict such a thing?
Well, we've looked at death, and we've tried to look at the characteristics. We've tried to measure the body to see if there's a soul, if the body died. We don't see any noticeable change. Brain activity, we use, EEG scans to look at brain activity. And, we find there's no ostensible signal that is given out when the body dies. However, you know, cats have been known to, animals, dogs especially, have been known to sense things that humans cannot. Dogs can sense frequencies much higher than the hearing range of the human ear. But even with instruments, it's very difficult to detect the instant that a person dies, even with our most sophisticated instruments. Brain death, for example, we used to think would be a characteristic of death, but, you know, the body can still live on even after you're brain dead. So even the definition of dying is a little bit vague when you can extend the life of a person whose brain activity is flatlined to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So even with instruments, we have a hard time doing that.
But is it possible a cat was sensing something that our instruments simply haven't been able to measure?
Well, it's conceivable, but again, you know, science deals with measurable quantities that are reproducible.
Right.
It's hard to reproduce that experiment because people only die once. And so, but again, if people wanted to study this, they would put this cat in a hospital. And of course, all the patients would run for their lives. But, you know, in a ward where they had terminally ill people, perhaps you can experiment with this under controlled conditions. So it's hard to say unless you have a controlled environment like the emergency ward of a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this new quantum world, it's hard to say impossible, period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to Dallas, Texas, and Tony. Hi, you're on the air, Tony.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's good to have you guys on the line. I just had a couple of quick questions. Could it be that dark matter is intersecting matter from multiple universes or even multi-dimensions?
Hmm.
And could light be the same in all universes or all dimensions, and that could that be the reason for its quirkiness?
Okay, well, there are two leading front-running theories about dark matter, which makes up most of the universe. Our atoms are the minority. Atoms only make up 4% of the universe. Dark matter makes up 23% of the universe. And dark energy, which is even more mysterious, makes up 73% of the universe. So, but one of the leading theories is that there's a parallel universe hovering above ours, that any star or galaxy in this parallel universe would be invisible because light passes beneath it, and it would exert gravity because gravity is the warping of space. The space between these universes can be warped, so you would feel its gravity, but it would be invisible. So believe it or not, one of the major theories as to what dark matter is, this invisible matter that holds the galaxy together, that invisible matter could be ordinary matter hovering above us in another dimension. And you mentioned that these other universes would have different laws of physics. That's right. Usually you say the laws of physics are the same throughout the universe. Well, in our universe, the laws of physics are the same. But in these other universes, you could have different laws of physics. And light is one of the solutions of string theory that's very easy to get. It's very easy to get the symmetry called U1 of light from string theory. So you're right that many of these universes would have light in them, just like our universe. But these other universes, perhaps protons don't live as long, or perhaps stars never ignite, or perhaps stars burn out very quickly. These other universes would literally have different laws of physics.
Okay. Way up north, Toronto, Canada, brings Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I love it when you guys are both on together. Okay, quickly, you mentioned, Michio Kaku, professor, negative matter. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little more what that is as opposed to antimatter. Mm-hmm. And if you have time, if you could explain what quantum foam is, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, antimatter is ordinary matter with opposite charge. And when antimatter and matter collide, all hell breaks loose. An antimatter bomb would crack the Earth in half if you have enough antimatter. A teaspoon of antimatter would be equivalent to several hydrogen bombs. Now, negative matter, on the other hand, would have anti-gravitational properties. Antimatter, we think, falls down. We've never done it. We've never had enough of it to show it. But we think that antimatter falls down. It's just ordinary matter with opposite charge. But negative matter would fall up. If there was negative matter at the beginning of time on the Earth, it would have left the Earth billions of years ago. So it's very difficult to find negative matter. Now, we're very much interested in negative matter because if a meteorite could be found made out of negative matter, it would have time travel space warp properties. You stick it into Einstein's equations, and all hell breaks loose in Einstein's equations. All of a sudden, space curls up. All of a sudden, time loops form. All sorts of Twilight Zone-like things happen when you stick negative matter into Einstein's equations. And one day, if a negative matter meteorite were to hit the Earth, who knows, maybe you would have something like Lost, where you had these bizarre things happening at an island.
Now, I was just about to ask you if the people at Lost had consulted with you.
No, but I did write an article for Popular Mechanics saying that that's the most logical way to explain many of the shenanigans that take place in Lost, that underneath this island is a negative matter meteorite. There was one episode where a woman actually laid out more or less that the island is the focus of many tunnels, and that's probably what this negative matter meteorite would do, that maybe this group of scientists found this negative matter meteorite and protected it, and it opens gateways to other ports within the Earth and other parts in time. So that would be one logical way to explain the TV series Lost.
Perhaps that is how they will explain it. We'll all see eventually.
I'll find out.
That's right. Hobie in Davis, California. Hello there.
Hello, Mr. Bell and Professor Kaku. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be talking with you guys right now. I'd like to start out by saying that the recent conversation about basically retinal altercations and body scans is of particular interest to me because I'm a blind, totally blind chemistry student up here at UC Davis. So that was a very interesting talk. I have two questions, and I'd be happy to take my answers off the air. Number one, Dr. Kaku, is do you believe that we will find extra-dimensional hyperspace in the Large Hadron Collider? Like, do you think it is definitely possible? And number two, string theory is such an incredible study and an incredible theory, but it is so theoretical in its mechanics. Do you think the optimism of string theorists will be affected if we don't find what we're looking for with the Large Hadron Collider?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, the Large Hadron Collider, we hope, we're crossing our fingers, we'll find dark matter. And one of the leading theories of dark matter is directly from string theory, that it's either a higher octave of the string or it's a parallel universe hovering just above us. So the Large Hadron Collider may actually give us experimental evidence of a parallel universe. Now, some people fear that it could create a mini black hole. But what is the theory that allows the Large Hadron Collider to create a mini black hole? Again, it is string theory, that if there is a parallel universe hovering above us, then gravity can be altered at very high energies so that black holes can form. So even the fear that some people have, which I think is misguided, but even the fear that people have of the Large Hadron Collider is a direct consequence of the existence of a fifth dimension. A fifth dimension would allow many black holes to form, which would instantaneously evaporate. So, yeah, you're right. The math is very difficult. I've written several textbooks on string theory for third and fourth year PhD students. They're required reading around the world, in fact, if you want to learn string theory. It's all mathematics. But eventually, we think the mathematics will see the outlines of it being proven by the Large Hadron Collider. But even if the Large Hadron Collider fails, even if it fails, we still have the problem. How do you unite gravity with the other quantum forces? String theory is the only game in town. It is the only theory that can combine the quantum theory with Einstein's theory of gravity. People ask me the question, well, give me an alternative. Maybe I don't like string theory. What's the alternative? And the answer is, there is none. This is the only game in town.
Okay, Professor, I've got a question for you, and no way do I mean to embarrass you or to put you on the spot.
Oh, go ahead.
But I'm curious about this. I'm told that people in your profession, theoretical physicists, have to do their great work, if they are to do great work, when they're pretty young. I mean, very early on, late teens, early 20s, maybe up to 30 or something like that. And if it doesn't get done in those early years, it doesn't get done. Is that myth, or is there some reality to that?
It's myth. However, there is some reality to it. If you take a look at the formation of quantum mechanics, which took place in 1925, the people who did it were only 25 years old. They were born around 1900, and in their 20s, Heisenberg and these people worked out the quantum theory, which is quite remarkable. Einstein was 26 when he worked out the theory of relativity. Isaac Newton was 23 when he worked out the theory of gravity. However, it doesn't mean that it has to be that way forever. The reason is that when you're young, you're open to revolutionary ideas. When you get old, you know too much. You know so much, you say, ha, that's not possible. Ha, that's not possible. And you miss what's sitting right in front of you. Oh, how did Einstein get relativity? You know, Poincaré and other people were very close to getting relativity. But no one could make this leap that Einstein said. People knew that objects might contract as you get faster toward the speed of light. Lawrence, Fitzgerald, many people knew that. But they couldn't get themselves to say it, that space itself is contracting. Not that objects are being squished, but that space itself is squishing the object. It took a young man, totally open, to make that idea. So we still have older people. Einstein was productive into his 60s, in fact, because they're open to new ideas. So the danger that we physicists face is that we get to know too much. That's the problem.
Well, that's what we all face. It's not just physicists, but I see how it applies to your profession, and that's really fascinating. And so I guess as a physicist, you worry about the acquisition of additional knowledge. It's something that I guess eventually produces kind of like a writer's block.
Yeah, that's a problem. You know too much, and you say, ha, that's not possible, and you miss some of the big ideas staring you in the face, and you wonder, how could I have missed it? I mean, we look back at Einstein's theory, and we say, how could they have missed it? They were so close, not just Einstein, but four or five people were so close to getting special relativity, and they were all old. And Lorentz was already in his 50s and 60s, I think, when he was already working, and they were too old. You do have to have a fresh mind. But, you know, if you are older, then you have to keep that in mind constantly. Think like a young man, you know. Throw away ideas that are cherished to see what happens.
I'm curious. I want to close with this question. It's very curious for me. I mean, a scientist is pretty much you stay in your own world as a scientist. But here you are suddenly. Now you're on television, you're all over Discovery, now you're on Science Channel and on and on and on. So people are now recognizing you on the street. And what's it like for you as a scientist? Is it a little unnerving to be recognized virtually everywhere?
Well, I keep remembering a famous encounter between Charlie Chaplin and Einstein. Einstein was touring the United States and went to the debut of one of Charlie Chaplin's movies. All the flashlights were going up, people were clapping, and so on and so forth. And then Einstein said to Charlie Chaplin, what does it all mean? And then Charlie Chaplin said, well, first of all, people love me because they understand me. They love you because they don't understand you. But then Einstein said, but what does it mean? And then Charlie Chaplin said, absolutely nothing.
All right. As always, it has been such a pleasure to have you on there, and I look forward to the next time. Good luck with your new program. I don't think you're going to need it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good night, my friend. All right. There you have it. That's one of the great minds of the universe. I will I can actually tell you when I'll see you again. It'll be Sunday evening in the U.S., Monday afternoon here in Manila, Philippines. So from Southeast Asia, I'm Art Bell. Good night, all.